This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. The U.S. Postal Service's unofficial motto, which is on a post office building in New York City, goes like this. Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night stay these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. Notice that it doesn't take into account the Internet or the U.S. government. The Postal Service is losing millions of dollars a day because of competition from email, and its future is uncertain because of some of the demands and requirements from Congress. The latest money-saving move is stopping mail delivery on Saturday except for packages starting this August. It's also a popular move based on polls, even one done by the Postal Service. So today in Radio Times, we look at the post office's unique history, the challenges it faces, and how it could be restructured. And we asked Richard John to join us. He had a piece recently in the New York Times titled How the Post Office Made America. He's a professor at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. He's written several books, including Spreading the News, The American Postal System from Franklin to Morse, and Network Nation, Inventing American Telecommunications. And he joins us from the studios of the Columbia Journalism School. And Richard John, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Delighted to be here, Marty.
When was the last time you mailed or received a letter?
I sent a thank you letter out last week.
Oh, that's so nice. I love thank you letters.
Yeah, so do I. It's something special about putting that stamp on it, and even though my handwriting's not so good, to actually address it and sign your name.
But you're part, and I think I am as well, you're part of a shrinking minority of people that actually send letters these days.
That's absolutely right. First-class mail, which what we call, what we think of, what the post office thinks of when we think of letters, it's been declining for many years, and that's a serious problem for the Postal Service since that's been their bread and butter for centuries.
And can we, I don't want to use the word blame, but is email, has email in a sense stolen some of that first class mail from the U.S. Postal Service?
Certainly has, as have just changing conventions. It's no longer considered to be obligatory to get your checks in the mail. It's now you're going to electronic there as well. In fact, that may be even more important than email, the business mail, a shift over from paper to digital.
I notice what comes through my mailbox, I'd say about half of it looks like junk mail. I'd say about 25-30% are catalogs, some of which I want, some of which I don't want. A smattering of some bills and a lot of letters from nonprofits wanting money. Is that what mail is today?
Pretty much, yes. You didn't mention magazines, and if you were living in a rural area, you might also have mentioned newspapers, which are still an important niche market. But yes, the nonprofits rely heavily on the mail, and the so-called junk mailers, they prefer to be called standard mailers, those direct mail solicitations, are critically important as well. So we're simply not sending as many letters, and we're not receiving as many magazines. You may be reading magazines electronically. Do you receive any parcels through the mail, I wonder?
Yes, occasionally parcels through the mail. And I know that I don't know if that's a profitable part of the post office, but certainly that's a part of the postal system that seems to be doing better than the letter part.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, postal administrators see that as a real opportunity for growth in the years to come. You can you can place an order with Amazon, and it can come in 2 days or possibly even same day through the post office.
I do want to talk about the history, but I'm also curious about what you think about the idea of the post office as starting in August, stopping delivery of letters, because I know letter delivery is part of the U.S. history, or the U.S. Postal Service history. What do you think of that decision by the Postal Service?
Well, I think what's most important to remember here is that the Postmaster General is making a decision based on how he sees the market situation, and I think we should respect his judgment. I think it's important to give the institution autonomy in making these kinds of decisions. But you ask historically, how important is 6-day delivery? We've only had it since the Civil War. 7 out of 10 Americans say they could do without it. It, of course, is a critically important issue for the postal unions, because an awful lot of jobs, or at least overtime, is on the line there. But that is not fundamental to the mandate of the institution as it has been worked out over the centuries.
The Postal Service says it could save about $2 billion a year, and as we know, it's losing something like $25 million a day.
Which sounds like a lot of money.
It does.
It was it was making money until recently, or at least breaking even, and of course that's part of its mandate. Since 1970, the institution has, under congressional mandate, been supposed to break even, and therefore when it loses money, this is a problem. This is was not much of a problem for much of our history, but it is a problem today. And from the perspective of the institution, I think it's important for us all to recognize that the Postmaster General has some tough decisions to make, and it seems to me that we as citizens have an obligation to let him make those decisions.
Let's talk a bit about this history, and we're calling you or we're joining you from Philadelphia, of course, the home of Benjamin Franklin. But you wrote in this New York Times piece that it was really George Washington and James Madison responsible for the post office. Help us understand this history.
Yes, I did. Benjamin Franklin, of course, was the first Postmaster General, 1775, and the newly established United Colonies, come United States. So he's got a venerable place in popular imagination, and he had been an imperial postal administrator before the war. But I think it's very misleading, and it's something that Postal Service has done for a long time, something that a lot of Americans do, pundits do, to say, well, our institution goes back to Benjamin Franklin, as if that's saying something fundamental about it. Because, in fact, the mandate for the institution, the civic mandate, emerged following the adoption of the federal constitution, which, of course, was adopted in 1788, drafted in 1787. And the key piece of legislation that set the post office on its modern footing not be enacted until 1792, after Benjamin Franklin had passed away, died in 1790. There's really no evidence that Franklin had anything to do with it. Now, George Washington, as President of the United States, was firmly committed to the proposition that the government had an obligation to circulate information on public affairs inexpensively throughout the length and breadth of the country. In fact, he had the quite remarkable, radical idea that newspapers should be circulated throughout the mail at no cost whatsoever. Now, James Madison, for good reasons, thought that was going a bit too far, but Madison shared Washington's commitment to using the mail to do something that really it hadn't done before, which is to create a public sphere for the circulation of information that would reach from one end of the country to another. And that was one of the goals of the Post Office Act of 1792, and it was a goal that was realized in very short order. You have a remarkable expansion of the network from about 80 offices to 800 and then into the thousands by the 1820s. And you have the provision that any newspaper that is printed anywhere in the country can be circulated through the mail for a very, very low cost. So it would cost a penny or a penny and a half at most to send a newspaper, which was big and bulky. It was just one sheet, but it was still much bigger than a letter, at a time when it might cost 12 or even 25 cents to send a letter. So it's a massive subsidy to the circulation of public information. Mm-hmm. And that's what Washington and Madison had in mind. That's why I think it's important that if we really care about the history of this institution and its mandate, as I think we ought to, that we start there, 1792, and not back in Benjamin Franklin's day or even the more distant past with the couriers and their appointed rounds and so forth and so on, as is so often the case. In many ways, it's a new and modern institution. It's not an ancient institution. And I think once we get over that idea that we've always had it with us in its current form, that we'll begin to think sensibly about what we want this institution to do in the future.
But what you're really describing, or at least what George Washington, James Madison were envisioning, is essential to democracy, the idea of shared information or information disseminated and shared with the people at a modest price.
That is absolutely right. And I think that's very important for us to keep in mind when we think about the future of the institution, because it does indeed have a glorious past. It would be inconceivable to envision the emergence of mass political parties, for example, in the 1830s, which we identify with the emergence of political democracy in the United States, without the massive subsidies that the post office provided, subsidies not only for circulation of information in thinly scattered regions, thinly populated regions, but also subsidies for the circulation of newspapers, information on public affairs. That's why I asked you at the beginning if you're getting any magazines in the mail,
right.
Because certainly that's a function of the post office that would have warmed the cockles of the hearts of Washington and Madison, circulation of information on public affairs.
But as you said, at a cost to the government to do that.
Well, here's
how cost to somebody to do that. But yeah, go ahead, please.
Here's how the cost worked. It's kind of intriguing. Until the 1840s, the post office made money in most years. And in fact, it even returned some money to the Treasury. Alexander Hamilton hoped that the post office would be a source of revenue to help keep the currency strong and to help keep the newly established regime on a firm financial footing. Now, beginning in the 1840s, number of reasons that ceased to be the case. And the post office then would run annual deficits more years than not. And that would continue right up through the 1960s. And there were long, ponderous debates in Congress every year about the postal deficit and what to do about it. But these debates mostly focused on how large the deficit was or what groups would be benefited, not on whether or not the deficit was a good thing. Because for most of our history, the consensus in Congress, and so far as we're able to measure it in the general public, was that it made sense for the post office to lose money because it was providing an absolutely essential public service that was indispensable to the public good.
You also said in this piece of that we read in the New York Times, and I found this interesting, mm-hmm. that when looking at the Postal Service, that it helped to establish this right to privacy, the idea that a letter that you sent to someone could not be read by the government, could not be read by somebody else. This was yours as it made its way through the mail system.
Yeah, I found this to be very intriguing as well in my research, and I'm a little surprised it's not been picked up on. Let's put ourselves back in the 1770s, 1780s. Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, John Jay, statesmen, they're in Europe as diplomats. And they take it for granted that their diplomatic correspondence is going to be opened across national boundaries. There was no presumption of privacy. The term was not even current at that time. 1792, Congress not only votes to create this mechanism for a hugely expanded postal network, have become far bigger than any network in anywhere else in the world, Britain or France. Also, the subsidies for information on public affairs, mostly newspapers and magazines, but also this presumption that personal correspondence was inviolate. That is to say, no government official could open your letter.
Hmm.
And that would remain the case well into the 20th century. And it surprises me a little bit that we don't make more of a fuss about it, because it distinguished the United States from the countries of Europe. We're a republic. In a republic, you don't open the citizens' mail. And it distinguishes us from the monarchies of the time. And it was a fundamental principle that was cherished from that moment forward. And it seems to me more attention paid to that would help us to understand the extent to which this institution is absolutely fundamental to values that as Americans we hold very, very dear.
Well, we are talking about the history of the post office, the postal system, as its future is uncertain. And Richard John is our guest. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Yannick Nezet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra perform Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, which premiered in Paris a century ago. Tickets at 215-893-1999. This Saturday at 8 p.m. at the Kimmel Center, Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring Centennial, performed in the concert version without any additional visual elements. Also featured Stokowski's Bach orchestrations with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
It may be the first time a rapper's broken out with a song about being thrifty.
I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket.
The rags-to-rags story of the suddenly superstar rapper Macklemore. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
I'm just pumped, I bought some from a thrift shop.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
That's a cold sound honky.
This is awesome.
Germantown Friends School Craft Show supports WHYY, bringing woodworkers, glassblowers, fiber artists, jewelers, weavers, ceramicists, and other fine artisans from around the nation to Philadelphia. The 29th annual GFS Juried Craft Show takes place March 1st through 3rd, Friday evening through Sunday afternoon at Germantown Friends School. Cafe opens Saturday and Sunday, serving sweet and savory treats. For details, 215-900-7734 or germantownfriends.org/craftshow.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. As you probably know by now, the U.S. Postal Service is facing some serious challenges from the Internet, also from the U.S. Congress. It has been losing money, and it has been taking some steps to curtail costs. The most recent action is stopping mail delivery on Saturdays starting in August, although packages will still be delivered. And we're talking with Richard John. He's a professor at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. He's a historian of communication, wrote a book called Spreading the News, The American Postal System from Franklin to Morse, also Network Nation, Inventing American Telecommunications. And we called him up after we read a piece in the New York Times recently titled How the Post Office Made America. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm imagining, and I'm putting myself back into the early part of the 19th century, as the country got bigger, obviously, for the post office, that required, a bigger institution or even bureaucracy to get the mail to the people, and including getting newspapers, which I'm assuming over time got bigger and bigger and heavier and more bulky.
They certainly did. Newspapers by the 1830s were around 95% of the weight of the mail.
Wow.
And they only never paid more than 15% of the cost. You shifted over to stagecoaches in order to carry the newspapers, and then over to railroads as well. Not everyone thought it was a good idea that you could have the same discussion in Maine and Alabama. In fact, there were serious proposals to circulate just news slips so that the news would get through, but not the opinion. Yet those proposals mostly went nowhere, although they would resurface again with the electric telegraph. But instead, we have this rather remarkable national discussion of public issues in which people from one end of the continent to the other were focused on the doings of a government. And foreign observers like Alexis de Tocqueville were absolutely astonished. He could not believe at the volume of information being circulated and the attentiveness of Americans to national public affairs. And that didn't just happen. That wasn't the result of market forces. It was a result of a civic mandate to facilitate the circulation of information on public affairs because of the presumption that the circulation of that information was indispensable to political democracy.
As you mentioned earlier, Saturday delivery beginning in the 1860s. Was there some kind of connection to the Civil War?
Yes, there was. It was a sort of an odd connection. Southerners in Congress were very eager to maintain their privileged status in the post office because as they were in rural areas and they tended to actually get more in postal services than they paid in. But they did not want to, among the things they did not want to pay for was city delivery, which would disproportionately benefit big cities of the Northeast, New York, Boston, Baltimore, Philadelphia. So when the Southern lawmakers were out of Congress, even though you'd think Congress had other things to do, it was relatively easy to get legislation and revenue to establish a city delivery. And with city delivery came Saturday mail. So that's where it came. Only for the cities, it would be much, much later that you'd get Saturday delivery in the countryside. And you could, throughout our history, over much of our history since 1810, you could go to the post office on not only Saturday but Sunday to pick up your mail. See, that's a different issue, whether or not you have Saturday and Sunday delivery by going to the post office. And it's my understanding that in many, if not most, perhaps maybe even all, post office boxes, if you have one, you can still get your mail on Saturday or Sunday. And the mail, of course, will continue to be moved on those days. It just, you will not have the familiar delivery person, the mail carrier, coming to your door.
I began with that unofficial motto of the post office, my understanding that it is on a post office building somewhere in New York. And the idea, I guess, of the letter carrier as, you know, nothing is going to stop the letter carrier from delivering that letter to I guess, the post office.
Yes, that adage refers to speed, and the idea, it goes back, actually, I think, to Persian messengers. And that was a time when the post office was absolutely essential to, or couriers really, because I'm not even clear you can talk about it as the post office, because it wasn't open to the public, when couriers were absolutely essential to administration of state. And that is not in an obvious sense true today, though if there were some sort of cyber attack, we would certainly want to have the post office as a backbone. But it seems to be misleading to focus exclusively on the post office and high speed, because the post office is much more than that. Yes, it delivers the mail quickly, but it's a remarkable sorting mechanism. It's a remarkable treasury of information about addresses. It's a remarkable administrative apparatus. And that dimension of the institution, it seems to me, is lost when we focus on the Persian couriers, or we focus on the Pony Express or Lance Armstrong or what have you. We're in effect trivializing the institution by treating it exclusively as a high-speed communication medium. It has been that in our history, but it's been much, much more, and it's much, much more than that today.
But are you saying the Pony Express, I'm sorry to ask you this because you said you don't want to focus on this, but do you think the Pony Express then was more sort of a PR Disney-type movie of the U.S. Postal Service?
Precisely. The Pony Express was established, I only understood this when I went to Washington, D.C. a couple years ago, and I saw that the major arms contractors were advertising in the subways. They said to me, why are you advertising missile systems? Well, it's to get the attention of lobbyists or lawmakers or whoever it is who's in a position to make the decision. In 1860, the contract for the Overland Mail was much contested, and it was a debate between the executive and the Congress. The executive had a favorite, and it was not this Russell Majors Waddell, this military contractor out in Utah. So they decided, well, we have to get the attention of Congress. And they came up with this flashy thing called the Pony Express. And they put their riders and spurs, and they, you know, got a lot of attention. In the end, they didn't get the contract. It was a failure. But it's not that important to the mandate of the institution, and it's really a sort of a publicity stunt that flopped. And if we would get our attention off that and off Benjamin Franklin and focus on the more fundamental things that the post office has done in our history, I think we'd be in a better position to go forward.
Obviously,
so sorry for all the Pony Express fans out there.
That's okay. We'll give them your direct phone number and they can call you. But what interests me is with all this focus on the internet, for instance, today, the internet essentially changing the mission and the financial future of the Postal Service. You have written about the telegraph, the telephone. It's not as if there haven't been other technologies that haven't challenged how we get information.
That's absolutely right. In the case of the telegraph, there was a long, really 70-year debate over whether the post office should take over the telegraph, establish a postal telegraph, as you had in Great Britain and France and European countries. We didn't go down that route, but it had the support of many prominent public figures, lawmakers, journalists, and the like. It really wasn't off the table until the First World War, and there were discussions about establishing some sort of federal government telephone as well. So, and there was never a debate at that time, well, the post office shouldn't get into new media, shouldn't get into new technology. No, the assumption was the mandate is the key, and the technology is the means to the end. So it seems to me that if postal administrators today want to establish a digital platform, expand their presence in digital commerce, that's entirely in keeping with the vision of the founders of this country. There's a question as to whether or not we wish to do that, but there's nothing in our tradition that suggests that the government should not have that kind of a presence.
One of the things that you say, and I guess it's true today, that the Postal Service or the Post Office is the second largest civilian employer after Walmart, which is number one. True?
That's right. And for much of our country, it was the biggest employer. And the post office provides jobs for classes of people, middle-class jobs, who often didn't have other kinds of opportunities, for veterans, for African-Americans, for the working poor. It's been an extremely important vehicle of upward mobility. And you only really begin to discover that when you actually go out and talk with the hardworking men and women of the Postal Service. And that, I think, is a fact that is worth keeping in the mix, especially as we are concerned about employment and we're concerned about upward mobility. of our entire population.
And that's Richard John. He's a professor at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. In fact, joining us from the studios of the Columbia Journalism School. And we're talking about the history, and we'll be talking about the future of the Postal Service. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So taking us up to present day, as you look at how the Postal Service or the postal system is structured, is that a sustainable business model, the one we have today?
You know, that's a great question. The parcel delivery business is expanding, the post office. And if you look overseas, German post office, Deutsche Post, has purchased DHL and is in quite an expansive mode. Maybe there's some lawmakers in the United States who'd like the Germans to come over and buy our post office and unleash it. I think there's an opportunity there. And in my conversations with postal insiders, I'm convinced that there is a potential in the digital marketplace. But the postal administrators today are not sitting back and hoping that first-class mail is somehow going to come back. Everyone realizes that that's not the future. And if we wish to preserve this institution, as I believe we have an obligation to our founders to try to do, that we need to figure out ways for it to become a vital institution in our digital age. And that's really what the debate should be about, not about pensions, not about six-day delivery, but do we believe that ordinary Americans should have access to information as a matter of right rather than a privilege, no matter where they live? And if so, what institutions are going to provide them with that access? And can the post office be part of that part of that mix?
And I do want to get to that because I think that's so important. But looking also at this structure, so you have a private agency. It's not funded by taxpayers, and yet it has to answer to Congress. And that seems like I don't even know what to call it, kind of a mishmash of its mission.
It is a mishmash, and it's extremely hard to explain theoretically. You can only really understand it historically. And it is a real disservice to the institution, the way it is currently structured, not only because it's beholden to Congress in ways that inhibit innovation, but also because it's under the aegis of the Postal Regulatory Commission that makes it very hard, say, to adjust rates. So it, in no way is it a business like, say, Federal Express or UPS. You don't have control over your rates, you don't have control of the kind of service you provide, and you are prohibited by federal law from going into new markets. And it seems to me that's the most pernicious congressional mandate of all, that you cannot innovate, in effect. Congress is prohibiting the post office from innovating, and it seems to me that is not the kind of initiative that we need from Congress. Congress should get out of the way, let the post office innovate. And I hope it will reconsider decisions that it's made in recent years that have really stymied the institution and tied it up with all kinds of constraints that no other enterprise of its kind confronts.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation at 1-888-477-9499, talking about the history and the future of the post office, the postal system. And we have, looks like, Gerhardt from University City joining us on Radio Times. And Gerhardt, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. I was wondering whether the post office, and I guess with Congress's approval, should consider going into retail banking as post offices have done successfully in many other countries.
It's a fair question. Now, Richard John, go ahead.
Well, that's a great question. In fact, the journalist Michael Lind raised that in 2008. In Japan, the post office administers this day one of the largest banks in the country, if not one of the largest banks in the world. We had a very successful postal savings system for much of the 20th century. I would see no reason the post office could not get back into the banking business. It did it very successfully. It provided as a savings, as sort of a location for immigrants who were very suspicious of commercial banks, and I think there is reason to be suspicious in this day and age of commercial banks. Whether that will happen or not is anybody's guess, but I think that's the kind of forward thinking that we should begin to entertain when we think about how the mandate of this remarkable institution can be adjusted to meet the challenges of our day. Certainly the Populist Party in the 1890s had a vision for postal savings banks. That vision was only partly realized, but it may be part of our heritage that we want to revisit as we contemplate the financial challenges that we are also aware of at the present.
and you talk about suspicion of commercial banks because of the financial crisis and what the commercial banks did a couple of years ago?
Sure. And just because the presumption that there should be stable institutions that guarantee the livelihoods of poor and people with modest means seems to me to be an essential civic mandate for the country. And that was one of the rationales for postal savings. If you cannot have a stable savings, it seems to be very hard for key elements of the American dream to be considered plausible.
Let me get Gerhard. Thanks for the call. We now have Faith from Center
it's
City,
a great
Philadelphia.
Call.
Yes, it was. Faith, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hi. I've heard that under the George W. Bush administration, there was a rule passed that the post office had to save for the pension of the postal workers 75 years into the future, and that this may have been a gift that George W. Bush gave to his donor, FedEx, and that that has impinged on the post office's finances to a great degree, and that the Internet sales would mostly make up for the loss of first-class mail if it wasn't for this requirement that they fund the pension so far into the future. What does your guest think of this?
Yeah, Richard John, go ahead.
Yeah, it's another great call. It's not until the historians are going to work out exactly what deals were cut in 2006 that we'll understand this story fully. Certainly the pension obligations that the post office was saddled with are very unusual, and they make it extremely difficult for the institution to have a positive a balance sheet. And that would be among the issues that it seems to me that Congress should address in relatively short order. I don't see it, though, as the crux of the matter, because the larger question is, how do we want to envision the institution in the 21st century? But yes, if the post office was not saddled with these extremely onerous pension requirements that no other government agency is saddled with, its balance sheet would look much better right now, and we might well not be having a discussion about a Saturday delivery. The 2006 Act also limited the new markets that the post office could have entered, and it did something that I regard as even more pernicious, was it started to define in very narrow economistic terms precisely what the mandate of the institution is. And there's a technical phrase here, the universal service obligation. I don't believe you can define the mandate of the institution so narrowly in terms that would meet the needs of the American people. Mm-hmm. It perhaps would make an economist happy, but it seems to me that's another part of the problem. It seems to me we need to revisit the 2006 Act and put the institution on a better foundation.
Faye, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're almost up in the break here, but do you think government or some members of government are essentially trying to kill the post office?
You know, I've wondered about that, and I don't, as a historian, I don't do the future. But if you look at a map of the United States and you look at the red states and the blue states, and you start to tote up which parts of the country are net beneficiaries of postal subsidies and which are not, the red states are doing pretty well. And it would surprise me if red state lawmakers got behind a move to significantly erode the institution. Mitt Romney in the recent campaign, he was all for privatizing Big Bird, but he didn't say a word about the post office. And so I don't think that there is going to be a congressional push to privatize the institution. But that's the future, and I suppose that's someone else's business.
Well, let's take a very short break. We're making it your business, Richard John. We are talking about the history, and we're sneaking in some questions about the future of the U.S. Postal Service. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
In Philadelphia, everyone is reading The Buddha in the Attic by Julie Otsuka, a poetic novel that traces the collective experiences of Japanese picture brides from the turn of the 20th century to the onset of World War II. A joint project of the Office of the Mayor and the Free Library of Philadelphia, One Book, One Philadelphia features 8 weeks of discussions, performances, and workshops through March 13th. Details at freelibrary.org/onebook. The Free Library of Philadelphia supports WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll look at a case before the Supreme Court challenging the Voting Rights Act. Some states say they've overcome roadblocks to voting. The Obama administration says they've created new roadblocks. Also, farmers in Kansas and Oklahoma hoping all that snow means an end to the drought. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
today at noon on WHYY. St. Joseph's University supports WHYY and shares its commitment to a better informed public. Through academics, social justice programs, and real-world experience, SJU is committed to inspiring students to develop their talents and give back to the world around them. More information about St. Joseph's undergraduate, graduate, and degree completion programs is available at sju.edu/livegreater. St. Joseph's University. Live greater. That's the Magis.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the U.S. Postal Service and democracy with our guest, Richard John, professor in the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. He's essentially a communication historian. He's written several books, including Spreading the News, The American Postal System from Franklin to Morse, and Network Nation, Inventing American Telecommunications. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, if I can have you look into your crystal ball, at least temporarily, but trying to imagine or reimagine the post office, and we had a caller that had some comments about this, but why not act more like a supermarket or a bank or a business? I know that the post office is introducing a clothing line, rain, heat, and snow. I mean, it seems to me that there are business opportunities, and perhaps the USPS is just shackled by some of these requirements from the U.S. Congress.
Marty, there are many, many business opportunities for the post office, and the opportunities are well known to postal administrators. They've been well known for years, but unless we can develop a national consensus that we should unshackle the institution, permit the institution to innovate, then these opportunities will not be realized. And it seems to me that that is the message that Americans who care about the institution need to understand, that the institution is not free to move into new markets, it's not free to innovate, because it's constrained in so many ways by the Congress and in some ways by the institutional framework out of which it has emerged. So sure, banking, all kinds of retail services, why can't you put advertisements on post office trucks? The list is long, and we're beginning to see in Europe some of these possibilities emerge, especially in Germany. You know, the sale of Royal Mail in Great Britain is on the table, and there may be some changes in the offing there. But there's got to be a consensus that the civic mandate to access to information, this community-building, nation-binding function is important, is something that we value, and is something that this institution has provided extremely well for a very long period of time, a claim that can be made about a very few other institutions in our country. And if we reach that consensus, then it seems to me it will be possible to get the lawmakers to do the right thing, or at least that's my hope.
Let me ask you another basic question, then we'll get back to our callers, because I'm thinking of the, you know, package delivery and the private carriers, FedEx and UPS. You and others have written about the fact that the U.S. Postal Service is responsible for last mile parcels, the idea that if someone lives way out in the boonies, it's the U.S. Postal Service that actually makes that delivery. Can you expand on
right.
that?
Yeah, that's really quite important, and I don't think it's well understood. The Federal Express, UPS, and the Postal Service are more collaborators than they are competitors. The Post Office has this unique last-mile capability. That is to say, it is obliged to provide postal facilities virtually everywhere in the United States, certainly every part of the country that's inhabited. Federal Express and UPS do not have such a mandate, so quite sensibly, they contract with the post office to provide this last-mile service. And if the post office were not around to provide that service, you would see the cost of mail delivery, all kinds of mail delivery, parcels, Netflix, whatever, go up in the thinly settled, hard-to-reach parts of the country, and maybe conceivably it would even go down in the big cities. And that's something that Federal Express and UPS, so far as I understand their business strategy, do not want to see happen. That is to say, they are very comfortable working with the post office, and that, in fact, you could make a good argument if you wanted to limit congestion in Manhattan, where I live, Why not have only post office trucks during the last mile? And FedEx and UPS then would give that business to the post office, and we'd rely on them for some of their superb connections using the hub and spoke airline links. In other words, the institutions are much more cooperative than they are competitive. But only the post office provides the last mile for every American, and it does so in obedience to its civic mandate to provide us all with access to information to help us stay connected, to bind the nation.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Bethel from Ardmore joining us on Radio Times. And Bethel, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks, Professor John. I'm a big fan of your work. And
thank you.
I wanted to ask you about the problem of postal treaties with other countries. I mean, if we were to privatize, isn't that a sort of primary role of the federal government? It seems like the post office, a major part of it is about U.S. diplomacy with other countries.
And this is part of the history. Yes, go ahead, Richard John.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. It's actually something a number of us are starting to do serious research on. There's so little work done in so many dimensions at the post office. Some of the first international treaties, Universal Postal Union, were in this realm. And in fact, it was an American Postmaster General, Montgomery Blair, around the same time we started up City Delivery, who thought it would be a good idea to get the European countries together in order to establish protocols. And these protocols became precedents for all kinds of standard setting and communications. So, yes, I'm not sure what would happen if the legal standing of the United States Postal Service changed. You had partial privatization in European countries. Certainly in the late 19th century, the United States was able to enter into international agreements in the realm of telegraphy when we had a corporation, Western Union, as the dominant carrier. European governments coordinated it. But this is a dimension of the history of the post and of its mandate that I think is impossible to underestimate, which is that it links not only Americans, but it also links us really around the world. And we forget what a miracle that is. So it's a terrific question. And I hope that maybe there'll be callers out there who are going to get their work in the libraries and do the research we need to understand this vitally important but neglected dimension of the history of our global age.
Bethel from Ardmore, thank you so much for joining us. And you can join us as well. Looks like we got a lot of callers here that want to get in on the conversation. And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Richard John, it's so interesting. We posted some information yesterday on our Facebook page about this, the show that we're doing today, and there seems like so much passion for the U.S. Postal Service. And I also know that the majority of people feel like if we lose Saturday delivery, it's no big deal. But nonetheless, I'm interested in the kind of passion people have for the service.
Yeah, when I did my New York Times op-ed, I was startled as well. Perhaps surprise isn't the right word for it. Steve Hutkins, an NYU professor, has a blog post called Save the Post Office, and a lot of Americans are writing in there. This is an institution that Americans have had very strong feelings about going back generations, very personal, very visceral. There's a kind of a sanctity to their connection with the post office that is different from connection with other institutions. It's partly because it is so intimate, it's so personal, it's something that ties them with their heritage, with the family. Even though they don't write letters, they wish they did, and they remember their grandmother wrote to them when they were young. And so, yes, I think that lawmakers should pay attention to this public groundswell of interest in the institution. And if the Postmaster General can find a way to retain Saturday delivery, I think that would be terrific. My point on that issue is simply that we need to give the administrators the kind of autonomy to make the decisions that they feel that they need to make. And I think that if ordinary Americans would like to organize to show their appreciation for the institution, especially those Americans in parts of the country that would be the most effective, I think that could be quite significant politically.
Do you also think the fact that it's a system that has mail carriers? I mean, I know the woman that delivers, Michelle, she delivers mail at our house. She knows my dog. That it has, that sort of personalizes what this service is about.
Well, the mail carriers are real unsung heroes of our public fabric, and there are many, many stories about mail carriers who keep an eye on the elderly lady who's ill and make sure that she's picking up her mail every day. The mail carriers who are active in detecting crimes, or they simply are a presence in neighborhoods right around the country. We tend to like our mail carriers more than the clerks in the post offices.
Yeah.
But of course, it's not so surprising that there are those long lines in post offices because postal services are much cheaper than FedEx and UPS, and that's why Americans are willing to stand in line in order to get their parcel mailed. But yes, I think that's a real tribute to this hardworking, large, and relatively taken for granted a segment of our workforce, the mail carriers of our country.
But as I stand in that line and look around at my post office, and I have to say it's a pretty bleak-looking place, I do wonder if there isn't a way to make that a more enjoyable experience. I mean, it almost feels like you're in, you know, an old Soviet country waiting to buy stamps or something like that.
No, sure. I've had the same thought. I'm sure many, many Americans do. If the post office were able to move into businesses where it could compete, use its real estate to compete with neighborhood stores, compete with the mail delivery carriers in providing ancillary services. There are legal objections to this. They don't pay taxes on their real estate. But yes, this is not largely of the post office's doing why those spaces, once magnificent spaces, a lot of public art in the New Deal era was devoted to making the post offices glorious. The post office in New York City.
Sure.
That those spaces could be glorious, but you're going to have a new thinking about how the institution relates to the rest of our commercial infrastructure in order for that to occur. So I think for the time being, you and I, when we're in the post office, we're going to just be surprised or perhaps startled at just how a little seedy it is.
I'm not surprised anymore. Let me get William from Marion to join us on Radio Times. Hi, William. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you very much.
You're very
welcome.
My issue
really deals with what Professor John was just talking about, which is the role that they play. First of all, it's the most proficient, productive, efficient post office in the world. They're just not really allowed to charge for it. But one of the things they do is provide a presence in the neighborhood, much like the town wardens did in World War II for the British. I would offer that one of the issues we have with the world of terror is that we have the postal folks calling every day on every house in America. What role could we have them play? What role could they help in our efforts? Clearly, it might raise the hackles of the civil libertarians, but so be it. I think there's a valuable opportunity there.
Kind of the eyes and ears. Yeah, Richard, John, go ahead.
Those are two great points. Postage in the United States is much cheaper than postage in other countries. Americans don't realize that because you don't, you know, comparison shop between what it costs to send a letter in Switzerland or send a parcel in Germany. But it's a bargain. And yes, we could. There are all sorts of ways we could re-envision mail carriers and re-envision this local presence in the age in which we live. And there is some fresh thinking going on these subjects, and I hope that this fresh thinking will continue. And certainly that would be a way to help ensure a large, vital postal workforce, which is, I think, an important part of the equation.
William, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Steve from Macungie, Pennsylvania has to say. And Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I, as well as my wife, are rural mail carriers in this area.
Oh, great.
And we're just tickled pink with five-day delivery. We've both been working 6 days a week for a little over 3 years. And at our office, we have only five subs for 22 mail routes, so it's practically impossible to get a Saturday off when you want it. You have to plan a month ahead of time. We've been looking forward to this for a long time. I'm a 30-year career carrier, and I was planning on retiring, but this might actually keep me here a little longer.
Interesting.
I can just get a break once in a while.
Steve, do you like your job?
Oh yeah, I love it. It's I'm out in the middle of nowhere right now. My customers depend on me for packages and the very little personal mail we do get anymore. I agree with your guest completely. He's right on the money. our mail volume is down to nothing. I could work 5 days a week, and I'll probably end up getting paid the same because X number of letters need to be delivered every sure. day or during the week. So, and our pay is literally based on volume.
Oh, that's
and the miles we travel.
Oh, that's very interesting. Well, Steve, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Richard John a chance to respond. Richard?
Well, keep up the good work. And, you know, there are many parts of our country that are outside of the major metropolitan areas, which the post office remains a community center, a vital community center, and in which the mail carrier is an important link with the wider world. And I think if we're, you know, thinking about the future, many of the commentators on the post office are very web savvy, and they're sending emails, and they're you know, they have internet access. This is not true for a large percentage of Americans, and we have certain obligations, it seems to me, as a nation, to provide facilities to the entire population, not just the hip and the well-connected and the urbanites. And our rural mail carriers are providing those connections day in and day out, year in and year out, a service that no other institution in this or any other country is able to do.
Steve, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Richard John, I thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. It's a very interesting hour. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it, and I do hope that some of the callers will think about the role of this remarkable institution in our past and how we might re-envision it for the digital age of the future.
And that's Richard John. He's a professor at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. He's a historian of communications and joined us from the studios of the Columbia Journalism School, author of Spreading the News, The American Postal System from Franklin to Morse and Network Nation, Inventing American Telecommunications. For more information about Radio Times, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Information about programs past and present, access to the archive. You can follow us on Twitter, check us out on Facebook. You can get information about downloading podcasts, how to be a caller, and how to find us on Sirius Satellite Radio. That's whyy.org/radiotimes. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Katie Ricciardi is our intern. And Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder produced the program. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.